Nothing to lose, another time.
Welcome to Subject Object Verb, presented by Art Review. I'm your host, Ross Simonini. This is a show about the artist, the art, and the life as it is lived. The subject, object, and verb. In this episode, we explore these ideas through music, with an emphasis on the many ways of approaching the human voice. The artist Jacoby Satterwhite will talk about a track from his band Pat, which samples amateur song recordings made by his mother. Ariel Pink will discuss his unreleased private archive of voice memos, like the one you're hearing now. But first, the musician and writer Johanna Hedva will talk about the many extended vocal techniques and experimental vocalists they've studied on the path to writing their new album.
Man, beauty's so fucking dumb the fuck. 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 Man, beauty's so fucking
dumb the fuck. In 2009, after a decade-long break from making music, Johanna Hedva released the album The Sun and the Moon, a slurry of rich, harsh noise, industrial beats, and grainy samples. They describe this music as hag blues, made for those who feel best in caves. Hedva's upcoming album, which is called Black Moon Lilith in Pisces in the Fourth House, is radically different in technique, though similarly thick in its mood. It's a lugubrious fuzz of doom guitars and vocal aching in the form of a eulogy for their mother. To best express this, Hedva studied operatic and Korean pansori singing styles as a way of embodying the binary quality of their Korean-European lineage through a single throat.
Have played music forever, but I had never taken any kind of lessons, and I certainly never took any singing lessons. And singing, I think, just generally is such a there's a lot wrapped up in it around your sense of confidence and self-esteem. It's much more vulnerable, I think, to sing than to play an instrument. Well, at least maybe it is until you start thinking of your voice as an instrument. So starting to take singing lessons when I was in my mid-30s, in the wake of this, of my mother dying, when I was just sort of drowned and bathed in grief and couldn't really do anything else, it was an odd thing to only be able to do something in singing, like to use my voice and to think about breathing and to think about hitting notes and to think about, you know, kind of training the muscles in my torso. Like, it was a totally different kind of way of being embodied than the rest of my existence was at that time. So I started taking singing lessons with a classically trained opera performer named Jasmine Orpia. And she taught me some kind of fundamentals about opera, which like blew my mind at the time because I didn't know really anything about it. But when I had been singing before for like the 2 decades I had been singing, I was singing in the throat, which is apparently very bad technique if you're trying to do opera. So like Jasmine in the very beginning, like totally like dragged me when she was like, okay, why don't you sing something for me so I can get a sense? And I did. And she was like, yeah, that's a lot of throat singing. Like, it is like a deep, deep insult, you know? And I had no idea why. I was like, oh, well, like, where would you sing if not in the throat, you know? I mean, the idea, right, in most pop singers, most rock singers that you hear sing in the throat. And it's why you can kind of hear rock singers and pop singers lose their voice as they age. The idea in opera is that you don't sing in the throat, you sing up in the soft palate. So the point is to keep the throat from aging in opera. You want it to sound as clear as a bell. So throat singing would just be like ba 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 ba, like in the throat. But opera is like ah, like way in the back. And I remember in these first kind of moments, ah, like I didn't even know that I had that part of my head. Like she would be like, no, not in the throat, like up in the head. I'm like, where in the head? Like, like in the mouth? No, not in the mouth. Like, so it's this, it's against this soft, you know, part in the back of your throat that's up kind of against your like sinuses. And the idea is if you can get the sound up in there and it's propelled from the air kind of coming from your diaphragm, so from far away, then it will just naturally reverberate off of the bones of your skull. So it's like a little auditorium, your mouth. Which is also why when you see opera, the people, the singers are so, they kind of hold their bodies in a really stiff way. It's because they have to maintain this like column of air. So like, for example, like pop singers, when they're hitting the big moment, they like toss their head back and they're like, wah, you know. And you would never see an opera singer do this because it would cut off the air if they bend their throat too far. So the other thing about that is that like opera singers don't need to be mic'd, because if they can, you know, channel this air in the right way and get it to reverberate off of the bones of the skull in the right way, then it can be as loud as a microphone. You can be heard over an orchestra. Which is like fucking amazing, right?
So if the skull is used like this, what other parts of the body are used for vocalizing?
Well, okay, so maybe this is like a good way to segue into this thing I'm kind of positioning as an antipode with pansori, which is this traditional Korean kind of style of folk singing that is kind of close to maybe a Korean version of opera, in the sense that, only in the sense that in pansori, there's a narrative, there's a sort of dramaturgical arc to the songs, the singer is a character, and when they perform, it's very much like opera production, where they're in costume, there's sets, all of that. But it's virtually like the opposite sound and technique as Western opera. So I know that like in pansori, it's very much throat singing. I don't know how like technically close or far it is, or influenced by with or by Tuvan throat singing. I think there are different kinds of these sorts of singing. Like Qawwali singers like Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, they sing with a different kind of breath and place, where it's why it wobbles so much. And it's sort of so hard to describe these things, you know, in words. But if you listen to Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, there's this kind of high-pitched, just wobbling that the voice does, that's supposed to sound like ecstasy. So it's spiritual ecstasy or divine ecstasy, but also very much like erotic ecstasy.
It's the music of the Sufis, right?
Yeah, and what's interesting is they sit when they perform, when they sing. So it's kind of like, this is also, you know, some of the stuff that's interesting to me. It's like an opera, you're supposed to stand very straight and you have this whole production around you. And then in Qawwali singing, you are, you know, seated and you're breathing in such a way that's supposed to mimic produce an ecstatic experience in the singer and the audience.
Palpit maahi, hogi aale, palpit maahi.
So the idea in Pansori is that the singer's age and experience and wisdom is what is most valued, and they want the voice to reflect that. So the more aged and broken and ragged it sounds, the more beautiful. So all of the Pansori singers who are, you know, superstars are like they would be like our opera, you know, diva stars in the West. Pansori singers are usually quite old, and when they sing, they just sound like, you know, their voice has been through it. One of the great, you know, kind of tidbit facts about Pansori singers is to rehearse, they stand next to waterfalls and try to be as loud. My favorite is a woman named Kim So-hee, who was born in the 19-teens. And her records, which you can hear some of them on YouTube, are, I mean, it's such a mournful sound, the Pansori style, because it's not just the voice is ragged, but it's also telling this story. And so the singer very much becomes the character. But the, you know, trials and tribulations and struggles and pain and suffering of that character are supposed to be heard in the voice, which is very, very different than opera. In opera, you want to hear the trials and tribulations and suffering in the language. And yet, I mean, at least in my ears, opera singers kind of always sound like removed. They're like archetypal. They're not that actual character. They're not actually Medea, who, you know, had to kill her children. There's some archetypal voice that just sort of hosts the spirit of Medea. And so the sound of an opera singer is always really untouched or unblemished by the body. Whereas Pansori is the complete opposite. It's like you can kind of hear this grit. You can hear the breath. In this one recording I sent you of Kim So-hee, it just starts and you can kind of hear her even have to like get into the song. She's like having to warm up a little bit. She's like, you know, like.
So is the Pansori singing coming from the throat?
Yeah, so it's in the throat. And the idea of me, like the reason why I'm not really a Pansori singer, is because if I did try to do it, I would definitely damage my voice. Like that's the point of being a Pansori singer. So it's interesting, like whenever I do sing these songs that use it, I'm really aware, like I can just feel that they damage my throat even in the couple of seconds that I use the technique. If I like, for example, sing that, if I do like a performance of Black Moon Lilith like every day for a couple of days in a row, by the, you know, fourth or fifth day, I sound like a frog and my voice is very broken. And so it does do permanent damage, which is like kind of, it's kind of cool. It's like very metal to me, you know, like also that you like are, it's worth it to do it. But I also would love to still be able to hit these high opera notes. So I kind of am like testing, you know, I'm like not full on committed to being a Pansori singer enough. So I'm still like trepidatious sometimes.
How are these singers going on if they're damaging their voice like this? Aren't they getting nodules like you were talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Like that's kind of what's cool about it. Like I just saw when I was like finding links for this, I found a video on YouTube of a child, a young boy who's considered like a young Pansori prodigy, and they're kind of training him to be a pansori singer. I mean, I don't know if pansori is any more dangerous than, like, you know, I don't know, like the singer of the of any heavy metal band, or any pop singer who doesn't really have a good, you know, coach or teacher. You know, like Adele, I think, you know, has this amazing voice, but she clearly fucked it up and now she can't sing as well. You know, like I just read the Joni Mitchell biography and she lost her entire soprano range in the 80s, like by the end of the 80s. And so most of her, you know, most famous songs have this very high, you know, crystal clear, young, girlish, innocent soprano. And so she re-recorded a lot of her songs in the 90s with this new range, this like huskier, lower alto even. And there's all this speculation that she that her voice was so radically changed because she smokes like 4 packs of cigarettes a day. Marianne Faithfull also had this where her record in the 80s came out and her voice was just gone. This is why I sent the Odetta link, because she's very old in that clip. And in the end of the song, she's just coughing. And I love it so much. I mean, I love Odetta. I love everything that Odetta has ever done, but I particularly love her when she's older.
Something inside so strong. I know that we can make it. They're doing us a wrong, wrong. Oh. My pride was gone. Something inside so strong. Something inside so.
So this person's name is Junko. Junko is this very small, petite Japanese woman. I believe her day job is she's a dental hygienist. She very rarely performs outside of Japan. And what she does is she just gets on stage next to a Marshall stack. She wears black. She has sunglasses on. And she just screams for 45 minutes. But it's a very particular kind of scream. It's not a metal guy scream. It's not this throat guttural, you know, metal kind of deep, low scream. As far as I can tell, there is some technique there that she's doing to not damage her voice, but I kind of can't tell what it is. Her voice, her screaming is very high pitched. It kind of sounds like a screech. And yet, it has enough vocabulary to last 45 minutes. Like, it's not just one kind of screech. There's a really beautiful essay that Eugene Thacker wrote about this particular performance and about Junko, and he puts her in a lineage of women mystics that were written about in terms of doing ungodly things with their voices. So demonic sounds or animal sounds, which of course, you know, in a tradition of mysticism would put one in a more blasphemous realm. But it is to me like there is something holy or sacred about what she's doing. Because it's also she doesn't have really an affect when she's doing this. She just sort of stands there and she's not doing a lot of emoting or this affected, like, oh, I'm really screaming. Like, she's just standing there holding the mic and making these sounds for, like, an hour. It reminds me of this quote that Diamanda Galás said, that there are 400 ways to scream. the thing that she's doing, in especially in those clips of Vina Cava, is what's called polyphony, which is where you have multiple notes happening at the same time, which to do as a singular, as an individual person, yeah, it's like a miracle. It's not human. And you can hear them when she screams also, because she also does this thing where she screams on the inhale as well as on the exhale, which I frankly have no idea how she does that. That's like just amazing to me.
How do you arrive at using these different techniques when you're composing music?
Well, I think the clearest example is this last kind of, the last song on the record that was also the performance that I did. It's this grief ritual for my mother. It's a guitar, electric guitar and voice performance that has very much like beginning, middle, and end. And the first song and the last song are sort of like bookends, and they both, I tried to use both and swing between this pansori style and this opera style in each of the songs. The last song is maybe a clearer example because there's a long a cappella section where I'm trying to do it even in the same kind of phrase, where I'll start the phrase, say, in an opera place and then end it in a pansori place or vice versa, which frankly is like just an intuitive, like you just kind of feel around in your body. I mean, the lyric, for example, is just, I'm just repeating the same lyric throughout this section, but the lyric is, I need two coins, and it's a reference to in ancient Greece, when you died, your soul and body were taken on the ferry into Hades, into the underworld, by a ferryman, and you had to pay him two coins. So the kind of character of the lyric is someone who's died and needs the money to get into the underworld.
I first interviewed Ariel Pink in 2006, and it was one of the first interviews I'd ever conducted, and one of the earliest he'd ever given. He'd recently released his album Scared Famous, and this music was distinctly raw in its aesthetic, and low in its fidelity, recorded on a four-track in his bedroom.
Starting after three, all weekend only, supper time and tea.
As the decade went on, Ariel's popularity grew, and his sound became clearer and gleamed with high-quality pop production. When the time came to reissue Scared Famous almost 15 years later, we decided to do another talk, which will now be featured in the liner notes. As we were talking, he mentioned that he had this whole private archive of unreleased voice memos, which he treasured, and which he then began sending to me. Some of these were song ideas, some of these were the sound of him beatboxing while walking down the street, some were little jam sessions, and some were completely finished works, which he felt were as good as anything on his album.
The rose of I like experimental music, so I don't need to listen to things as finished products, you know. I am, in fact, it's kind of obnoxious to me to fuss over making records sound good and all that kind of stuff. It's a very, very tedious process, and one that, like, I'll go down the rabbit hole and I'll just, you know, I'll settle on something eventually, but it's kind of like a pain in the neck, and it's kind of like I just tend to lose myself with the sound and end up ruining it half the time, you know.
I think I'm inborn. Oh, not baby, not for you. I think I'm inborn.
But I'd rather just, you know, I think in terms of, I always like demos and stuff like that from other artists, you know, sort of like the off-record stuff, you know, the cutting room floor stuff, or the just, you know, the incidental sound stuff that they capture when the tape's still running after the song's over or whatever. All that kind of stuff is what I really always respond to for some reason. You know, where every record has, you know, its own reel of extra stuff, you know, non-album stuff, and that's sort of like the stuff that I eat up. Just because maybe it's something about it not having a cohesion, that, you know, with a record, having something be like in a record and be cohesive or be part of a record, it's great. It's just that, like, it actually is limiting to me for some reason, because I kind of hear pieces as being whole records unto themselves, and so I I kind of like the standalone aspect of various recordings, you know, various random recordings. Like, they just sort of exist in their own world. I like compilations a lot, you know. Like, I like things that, like, are just, there's no concepts behind it. It's just a slap together collection of odds and ends.
Such a nice day. Such a
It's the equivalent of having, like, you know, of watching a Spinal Tap, the DVD edition with, like, you know, 3 hours of, like, bonus footage, you know? Bootlegs had a lot of that stuff. You know, kind of like, you know, yeah, bootleg collections, which, you know, collect stuff that, like, you can't find on the actual releases. That used to be, like, the whole appeal for me, you know, is to hear the stuff that you couldn't hear anywhere else. And so like, when I was, like, in high school, I would love listening to, I would collect, like, these canned bootlegs, because, like, you know, I wanted to hear every jam they ever made, you know, especially from specific time period. So, and every time they played their stuff, you know, it was totally new and different, and so there was really no skirting around it. I had to hear all of it. So, but yeah, that stuff was available in various forms, with, you know, in bootleg releases, with just Xerox covers. is great.
It seems instructive for an artist to listen to the outtakes and all of the failed recordings, so you can get a sense that there's a whole artist behind this music and not just the hits, right?
Yeah. I think that's what it is. It's like you want to get the sense of a person, or you want to get the sense of like of you really well, you want to get the reality of the person, right? Or like the sense of a life is what really turned me on, I guess. Yeah.
Brant coming?
Yes.
What?
No, I'm not exciting enough for you.
What are you talking about? Do you want to plug an instrument?
Stop.
Oh, you want to talk? Okay.
I talk to the keyboard.
For every episode, we have an artist contribute a piece of sound to our 4-minute and 33-second column, which is our little tribute to John Cage's famous piece of the same name. This episode features Jacoby Satterwhite, who, as it turns out, was deeply influenced by Cage. Satterwhite makes highly complex works of virtual reality and sculpture, which all orbit around the music of his band, Pat. The music is conceived as a kind of remix of recordings by Satterwhite's mother, made many, many years ago, which include demos for pop songs and commercial jingles that never came to be. For 4 minutes and 33 seconds, he's playing a track off of the album Love Will Find a Way Home, titled Born to Be Free, which just happens to be the length of this column.
The San Francisco Museum of Modern Art gave me a huge budget in 2015 to create this virtual reality folk album. And what I wanted to do was to consolidate 155 acapellas written and recorded by my mother in the woods on cassette tapes in the South, when she was between, like, in her home in the woods and in the mental hospital. She made these American folk songs that she was trying to distribute to the home shopping network and jingles and commercials and to, you know, recording studios. Like, she had this delusion of grandeur that she would be like, you know, the next Carole King, but it was something that I was experiencing during childhood, that she was like amazing American folk songwriter, a bluegrass kind of like blues singer, you know, like in her living room singing these really poetic ballads that have like lyrics that are elegant as a Gertrude Stein poem. And when I got older, I realized that I wanted to archive those and make them into a digital big giant project. And when I got the money, I just went for it. So basically what happened is I thought it would be making an amazing sculpture if I, you know, if I like digitized her bare vocals from these cassette tapes and I got mastery with Ableton and Logic and Pro Tools with Nick Weiss. And we spent 2 years jamming away and making this album with Patrick Bigalaga and LaFonda and Kindness. And we had, you know, like we made a solid real album. And in between making that album, I was making the virtual reality and the 3D animation at home and in the studio and making sculptures around it. And I kind of developed this integrated whole, you know, landscape based on something that is so bare bones and foundational as a cassette tape. You know what I mean? Like a cassette tape birthed something so huge.
Born to be free. Born to be free. Born to be free. Everyone must be free. Born to be free. Born to be free. Born to be free. Everyone must be free. Born to be free.
Everyone just be free. Born to be free. Born to be free. Born to be free. Everyone just be free. Born to be free. about the way I used to be. I'm not the same, and that's the way I wanna be. Don't knock me down, and I will be good company, making the way for everyone to see.
About Jacoby's most recent work, take a look at his show titled We Are in Hell When We Hurt Each Other. It just came down at Mitchell and Nez Nash in New York and is quite bold, even in pictures. For more about Johanna Hedva, you can read my interview with them in the November issue of Art Review and online. It gets into topics we didn't discuss here, including the nature of being goth, sick woman theory, and their reverence for Nine Inch Nails. As always, feel free to send any revelations, good jokes, or holiday wishes to subject-object-verb@artreview.com. Thanks for listening.
I love you, baby, I love you. I love you with all of my heart. Life without you, don't know what I would do, 'cause I'm nothing without you, oh baby, and I don't think I'd make it without you.